This is The Takeaway for Thursday, June 1st, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. It's official. To President Trump, Paris is back to being just a tourist destination.
In order to fulfill my solemn duty to protect America and its citizens, the United States will withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord Thank you. Thank you. But begin negotiations to re-enter either the Paris Accord or in really entirely new transaction on terms that are fair to the United States, its businesses, its workers, its people, its taxpayers. So we're getting out, but we will start to negotiate, and we will see if we can make a deal that's fair. And if we can, that's great.
The president speaking from the Rose Garden at the White House, announcing that the U.S. will turn its back on the Paris Climate Change Agreement of more than 190 nations to pursue a domestic policy of economic growth and energy independence from the rest of the world. The biggest global effort ever to combat climate change will no longer include the biggest contributor to global warming of the industrialized nations, if you measure it over time. China and India are on their own now and almost instantly emerge as environmental leaders in the industrialized world. The U.S. and China together produce close to 45% of global emissions, so when their agreement was announced at the Paris conference during the Obama administration, it was a huge surprise and a legacy event of the Obama presidency, especially given environmental disagreements of the past. Spending just a few minutes breathing the air in Beijing will give you a tangible sense of the sudden urgency in China regarding clean air and the social and health costs of rapid industrialization. China's 1.3 billion people have pledged to peak carbon emissions by 2030 or sooner, and a report from Climate Action Tracker says it appears that both China and India are ahead of schedule, even as the U.S. turns its back on Paris. Joanna Lewis is an associate professor of science, technology, and international affairs at Georgetown University and author of Green Innovation in China, China's Wind Power Industry, and the Global Transition to a Low-Carbon Economy.
A lot of people compare the situation of the United States pulling out of Paris to when the United States decided not to ratify the Kyoto Protocol back in the late 1990s, and we're in a really different place now. The Paris Agreement had much more universal participation. 195 countries are part of it and have actually agreed to take on specific actions within their countries to reduce emissions. And you really have a different situation, I think, in terms of where we are in clean energy development around the world. A lot of these markets are growing rapidly. They make economic sense to be pursuing the development of low-carbon technologies. And I don't think this is all going to stop just because the United States decides not to be part of the agreement.
If China and India by themselves are able to compensate for whatever it is the U.S. doesn't do, what does the United States lose?
Well, China is a really interesting example where, you know, not only have they taken pretty strong commitments as part of the Paris Agreement, but, you know, they're doing this because it's absolutely in their domestic interest, and they have figured out that the key to their own economic success is transitioning away from an economy that's really reliant on energy-intensive heavy industry, you know, manufacturing most of the world's cement and steel. They are transitioning to manufacturing much more, you know, much higher value-added goods. These are more high-tech products. And this, of course, includes clean energy technologies. China's now the leading manufacturer of solar panels, of wind turbines, increasingly of batteries and electric vehicle energy storage technologies. And again, this is, you know, partly because of their climate change strategy and partly because of their current local environmental pollution situation. But I think it's really it's a smart industrial strategy on behalf of the country. And so, you know, if the United States takes less aggressive action on climate policy, this certainly influences these markets. It sends signals to the private sector about where we're heading in these technologies. And ultimately, it can affect our overall global competitiveness in these highly strategic sectors.
Is China on track to actually meet its goal on the Paris Agreement?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, when China announced its, you know, the primary goal of that it made in the Paris Agreement was to peak its carbon dioxide emissions around the year 2030 and possibly before that. At the time that was announced, that actually seemed like quite an aggressive target because China's emissions have been growing rapidly year on year with no sign of slowing down. But actually, just in the last 3 years, we've seen coal use in China decline for the first time in decades. And this was somewhat unexpected. This is a symptom of, in part, of slower economic growth we're seeing in the country, but also it's a result of many policies that have been put in place to clean up dirty coal plants to deal with the really severe air pollution problem we're seeing, particularly in eastern China. And so because coal emissions are going down, carbon emissions were actually starting to stabilize and possibly even decline. If this trend continues, and that's a big if because we're still, you know, a ways away from 2030, you actually could see China, you know, peak emissions much earlier and therefore not only meet their targets but exceed them.
Joanna Lewis is Associate Professor of Science, Technology and International Affairs at Georgetown University. She's the author of Green Innovation in China, China's Wind Power Industry and the Global Transition to a Low Carbon Economy. Professor, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The number three producer of greenhouse gases is India and has pledged and is projected to get 40% of its electricity from non-fossil fuel sources by 2022. Solar farms are selling cheaper electricity year after year. Andrew Light is a distinguished senior fellow in the Global Climate Program at the World Resources Institute. He's a former senior advisor and India counselor to the U.S. Special Envoy on Climate Change at the State Department. He says, to his surprise, India is already accelerating its emissions reductions.
I have to say that when I was at the negotiating table in Paris with the U.S. delegation, we had some serious doubts about where India was. We knew that the Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, was very much a climate champion. He'd actually written a book about climate change when he was the chief minister of the state of Gujarat. He sees a very strong, compelling moral reasons to respond to climate change. But we knew that there were members of his cabinet who were very soft on the prospect of India signing up for aggressive reductions under the Paris Climate Agreement. I look at those same figures today, and they have completely changed course. They are on board on Paris, and they keep making announcement after announcement that they're going to double down on their commitments on renewable energy.
Now, the atmosphere in Beijing is a tangible notion that, you know, urgency is certainly the order of the day in China. What accounts for the change in India? It's not exactly the same kind of tangible pollution.
Well, actually, it is. Delhi is the most polluted city in the world,
major city
in the world. And so that was actually one of the things when we were trying to come up with every single, you know, carrot and argument that we could put in our basket when we would go to Delhi for to try to get the Indians fully on board on Paris. One of the things that we offered them, in fact, was a program of international cooperation on air quality using the same playbook we'd use with China, arguing that air quality was going to be one of those things that was definitely going to incite interest among the Indian people for more action by the country on climate change.
Is the geography in India more challenging than in China? Valleys, et cetera, wind patterns, that sort of thing?
It's very challenging. I mean, there's lots of challenges. It's a very, very geographically diverse place as a subcontinent. But I think also part of this is that the Indians are acutely aware that they're already experiencing severe impacts of climate change in their own country. They're quite worried about the impacts of climate change on the monsoons. We did a lot of technical work with them, with the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration and NASA, other U.S. technical agencies, to try to help them to get better on predictability on how climate change would impact these seasonal patterns that are so critical to them. And then also, remember, you know, Bangladesh is right next door, which is a severely geographically challenged region. The Indians are quite worried about the impacts of climate change there and what that could mean with respect to the looming prospect of climate refugees.
So sea level rise produces destabilization and refugees in Bangladesh, and that's right across the border.
Right across the border.
Let's talk a little bit about something that's the case in China, but maybe more acute in India. And that is the use in rural areas and in non-industrial villages across India of very high carbon emitting fuel sources for just basically cooking and household, you know, household heat and energy. Is that something that, that is actually changeable under the Paris Agreement, and it would require a real change of heart on the part of the entire nation?
Well, the Indians, I think, have long recognized this as a kind of a national tragedy. Indoor air quality is just absolutely terrible because of these cooking sources, especially in areas off the grid. And so there were a number of measures that have been taken up many times in cooperation with institutions in the United States. Scripps Institute, for example, in San Diego, MIT has a very ambitious program on this to kind of work with individual villages, work with entrepreneurs to try to go village by village to get them to sustainable zero carbon or low carbon power sources. I think that the Paris Agreement has, if anything, accelerated their determination to do something about these problems. And part of the Paris Agreement was opening up and creating new institutions, financial institutions, institutions for sharing technology to help them to address these issues.
Distinguished Senior Fellow in the Global Climate Program at the World Resources Institute, Andrew Light, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Much more analysis on President Trump's decision later this hour, and we're hearing from you.
Margo Pellegrino from Medford Lakes, New Jersey. Considering the risk to people, property, and businesses, never mind mass extinctions, government should play a very strong role when it comes to climate change.
This is Jill Gajewski from Swarthmore, Pennsylvania. I think that Trump has turned this most critical issue of our time into a reality TV show. I'm ill.
Hi, my name is Christian, and I'm calling from New Jersey. I think if we pull out of the Paris Climate Accord, that it's absolutely devastating. It sends entirely the wrong message, and we're going in a completely wrong direction, and it's really disheartening.
My name is Rich from Bradenton, Florida. In physics, there are laws. Boyle's Law, Charles's Law, Newton's Law. I'd like somebody to comment on what law in physics there is that says climate change is a function of man-made issues.
My name is Twinkle Yoakum. I'm calling from Florida. We definitely need to stay in it for so many reasons in the Paris Agreement. But it's us not participating and denying climate change is sort of like setting the house on fire and then letting somebody else put it out. It's just ridiculous. But I feel like we're going backwards in science, and I'm kind of nervous about it.
This is Kelly from Toms River, New Jersey. I live on a man-made canal system, and we had a very big problem with Sandy. Sea levels are rising, it's affecting our communities, and I don't have representatives that take care of that action. I also work at an environmental center, which has trails that are falling into the water, and we have seen very low fish populations. It's overfished. The beach erosion is happening right now, and nobody's doing anything about it.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. A film produced by KQED in San Francisco attempts to portray an element of the U.S. criminal justice system not well documented, the parole system. It profiles the case of Marvin Mutch, who was 18 years old when in 1975 he was sent to prison for the murder of a 13-year-old girl found dead in a creek. He was sentenced to 7 years to life with the possibility of parole, but Marvin Mutch was released only last year, having spent well over two-thirds of his life in prison. The key evidence against Marvin was circumstantial, essentially amounting to whether his clothes were damp near the time of the murder. Those details were given to police during a fateful phone call by Marvin's sister Valerie, who thought she was identifying him as merely a witness to the case. Instead, her tip turned Marvin into the main suspect.
That phone call essentially put an end to whatever family I had. If I had just not made the phone call, then none of it would have happened. But I did. And he's the one who paid the price for it.
Marvin Mutch's case is the subject of the latest series from KQED's podcast Queued Up and an accompanying documentary, both called The Trials of Marvin Mutch. KQED criminal justice reporter Alex Emsley spent months working on the story.
The span of this man's adult lifetime spent in prison was really unique in that we could look at all of these different ways that California and really the nation conceived of the criminal justice system and ideas of justice and guilt and innocence over these four decades of time.
And then after many, many decades, just how disorienting interacting in the real world as we know it turns out to be. Here's Marvin himself.
How many eggs are there? This is unreal. In prison, they cook eggs. They break the yolks. So they break them and they make this hard rubber disc that's your egg.
What's he explaining there?
I think it gives us a little bit of a snapshot into just all of the little things and how they pile up. And when someone is suddenly again exposed to these things that have been simplified over a long period of time, that level of amazement. In this case, Marvin is really excited that he can get eggs with a runny yolk, something that he hadn't had access to in many, many years.
The sentence was what?
7 years to life. It was an indeterminate sentence.
Is it important for us to believe that Marvin is innocent, or is it important for us to believe that Marvin might in fact be guilty?
I know that we can't definitively say either way. So that is something that I think is sort of up for each person who watches it to kind of come to their own conclusion and ask the question of, also how much it necessarily matters. And I want to explain that a little bit. He was sentenced to a term of at least 7 years and then a possibility of parole and release based on not the heinousness of that original crime, the brutality of this murder, but based on whether he had shown rehabilitation and was likely to commit another crime. Lifer inmates, those who have been sentenced to up to life terms, and those who have spent a long time, many years in prison, have a much lower likelihood of ever reoffending than even the general population outside of prison. So according to the system, it doesn't necessarily matter by the time he was up for parole and continued to be denied for about three decades.
I went to 22 board hearings, and I came to realize that there really is no formula. There is no formula. Sort of like the weather, certain things happen at a certain time. You have the right governor in place, and you have the right attorney with you, or you have the right district attorney showing up. Any of these components not being present, then it doesn't happen.
Do you believe that Marvin's insistence upon his innocence was the thing that kept him in prison?
It's certainly possible. And at points, there are, statements on the record in transcripts of parole hearings that very clearly indicate that. But it's not, it's a little bit nuanced. It's a little bit complicated. Marvin Much did not maintain his own innocence throughout his entire lifetime. After several years in prison and several denials at the parole board, telling him basically that he had to accept responsibility for this crime before he would ever have a chance of getting out, he says that he came up with a story, a way to try to accept responsibility, to basically say that he did this crime or at least played a role in the murder of Cassie Riley. Law enforcement officials in Alameda County investigated his story and found it to be physically impossible, according to the evidence in the case. So it was never really believed, but it caused him a major credibility problem. When more evidence then came out in the case decades later, Marvin feels like it shows that he's likely innocent of this crime. And he went back to asserting that in front of the parole board and then heard the same thing again, that his denial of the crime was not plausible. And until he accepted responsibility for it, it was a impediment to him ever being seriously considered for parole.
Why was he released?
Well, he was granted parole, actually for the second time in recent history, and it was not reversed by the governor. California is one of three U.S. states that allows the governor to review and change decisions of the parole board in murder cases. And Marvin had been granted parole also in 2006, but that decision was reversed by Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. This time, it went through, and after 41 years, he was released.
does the system have any basis for making that judgment? I mean, do they? It just feels so completely arbitrary.
It's discretionary. A longtime prisoner's attorney who attempted in 2010 to get Marvin Mutch found suitable for release at the parole board described the parole process in California as one of the most lawless places he can imagine. They're not open to the public, and there is a perception that the decisions are very arbitrary. But I do have to say that there is all of these different factors that they look at add up to a likelihood to reoffend or a legitimate rehabilitation. And it's especially, I think, difficult for them to make that consideration without the criteria of, do they understand why they committed the crime in the first place? And do they show, you know, appropriate remorse for that? A claim of innocence negates all of those factors.
Alex Emsley, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Alex Emsley is a criminal justice reporter for KQED in San Francisco. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckabee. A potentially damaging investigation into the working conditions at a factory in China that assembles Ivanka Trump's shoes seems to have been mysteriously shut down. Two undercover activists are missing, and another has been detained by Chinese police on illegal eavesdropping charges. They were working for the New York City-based nonprofit China Labor Watch, which claims that this is the first time they've had any investigator detained in the country. The activists were near the end of their three-month investigation into the working conditions at the assembly facility for the Ivanka Trump brand and were set to expose some pretty uncomplimentary details. Joining me now from Hong Kong is Benjamin Haas, China correspondent for The Guardian.
By American standards, the conditions in this factory were definitely deplorable. But in terms of Chinese standards in Chinese factories, this sort of behavior is quite rampant.
What sorts of things would we learn in this report, perhaps?
Probably the largest violation is excessive overtime. You know, it's very common to work 60-hour weeks doing repetitive tasks for very low wages, and they're frequently unpaid for many breaks that they take. There's a lot of verbal abuse on these factory lines and a lot of abuse directed towards women as well.
Although what's unusual here is that somehow the undercover activists are missing. Is there any evidence that the Trump organization might have influenced the Chinese government to take these folks off the street?
There's no evidence of that at this point. I would be quite surprised if they had known about the investigations before the report was released. In terms of my understanding of the situation, it's most likely local Chinese police who took this initiative, possibly because of the factory's link with the Ivanka Trump brand.
But it is pretty unusual that something like this would happen, yes?
It is. And China Labor Watch has been conducting this type of investigations for almost 20 years, and they've never had anyone formally criminally detained, which is quite serious in China. The country has a 99% conviction rate. So if you get arrested, you're going to jail.
And illegal eavesdropping charges, I mean, is that something that is scandalous in any way in China?
It may not actually be a crime in China. One expert in Chinese law that I spoke to said that he's never heard of this charge of illegal eavesdropping. So far, the only information we have on the arrested man comes from a phone call from the local police to his wife, and she has not been able to actually get in contact with the police since that initial phone call. So it's not exactly clear what the list of charges is. This is sort of just what they told her in the initial phone call.
Does China Labor Watch intend to publish a report even though these investigators are missing?
The executive director right now said he was focused on assessing what the activists, the situation of the activists, and he's not really looking at the time to publish a report. He's mostly advocating to get them out of detention and find the two missing activists.
Benjamin Haas, China correspondent for The Guardian. Thanks so much, Ben.
You're welcome.
And now, free speech, raw emotion, and worries about civil unrest in Portland, Oregon, which is still reeling from the stabbing deaths last week of two men on a public transit vehicle. Given the grief and ambient emotion in Portland this week, Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler took an extraordinary step.
I'm calling on the federal government to immediately revoke any permit or permits that they've issued for the June 4th event, and I'm asking them not to issue a permit for the June 10th event. Our city is in mourning. Our community's anger is very real, and the timing and subject of these events can only exacerbate what is already a very difficult situation.
The two events he's referring to there are a free speech rally in the city on Sunday and a June 10th rally that is reportedly anti-Muslim. Organizers of the June 10th event responded to the mayor by canceling their anti-Islamic Portland March Against Sharia. But this weekend's rally is still scheduled to proceed, and the mayor's efforts to silence demonstrations raises long-standing questions about the protections for free speech in the public square and on the university campus. Tony M. Massaro is a professor of constitutional law at the University of Arizona James E. Rogers College of Law. She joins me now from Tucson.
First, hate speech is protected speech. There's no exception. Second, permits for speech can't be denied on the basis of viewpoint, and this denial would likely violate the rule. And third, to your point, there's no general fear of future violence exception to free speech on politically charged topics when expressed in public forums. So we can protect ourselves from violence, but the government is under special scrutiny if it just is anticipating the violence versus waiting to see what happens in the actual speech scene.
Is a mayor of an urban area the size of Portland rationally permitted to use the statistical incidence of civil unrest based on similar speech nearby, around the country, directly in response to the kinds of rallies, et cetera, that are being envisioned here in this June 4th and June 10th event?
I have a lot of sympathy for him, and the evidence may be compelling, but it still is not, as a matter of First Amendment law, sufficient. I think similar evidence probably could have been amassed, say, in the 70s when the neo-Nazi marchers wanted to march in Skokie. We know about the Westboro Baptist Church picketers at deceased soldiers' funerals. Examples abound where government actors like the mayor very responsibly are concerned about the strong likelihood of violence. And everybody knows Portland's grieving and raw, but there are other strategies available to the mayor and to the community, and the First Amendment requires them to exhaust those first.
And time did not ameliorate the notion of grieving for the folks in Skokie, Illinois, who were wearing numbers on their wrists, correct?
And arms, that absolutely correct. And having seen it, you know, it was an extraordinarily, there was no question that the protesters were going there in order to communicate that message to the most potentially vulnerable population, period.
When something like this happens, I mean, do you say, oh, great, we're going to be testing the First Amendment, or is there something else that happens in your gut that makes you feel like this is something that you wish didn't happen?
When these sorts of things occur, I wish that people were more mindful of the multiple constitutional values at play. The First Amendment is extremely important and has been throughout American history. By the same token, the impact of words and the effect on the community and the effect on the other constitutional hand clapping, which is equality, I would love to see in this context not just a discussion about the First Amendment, which is fundamental, but about the other fundamental values at stake, and see if we could do a better job of engaging in the kind of discourse that the First Amendment in theory is about. So, no, I don't think of this as a happy First Amendment occasion. I do think it's a teaching moment and a sobering one. I mean, look at what's happened to Portland.
Tony M. Massaro is a professor of constitutional law at the University of Arizona James E. Rogers College of Law. She spoke to us from Tucson. It's a story of Saudi Arabian scale wealth in the middle of a dry, inhospitable part of Oklahoma. In the late 1800s, the Osage Indians found themselves in a situation where the supposedly valueless land they were settled on was found to have extraordinary wealth in the form of oil below the surface. And the Osage, in this case, actually owned the mineral rights. The legal and geological facts made the Osage some of the wealthiest people in the world by the first few decades of the 20th century. But then they started dying off mysteriously in a case of greed and brutality and jealousy. It was a case taken up by the young FBI. David Grant, a journalist, spent half a decade researching and writing about how the oil-wealthy Osage killings would become one of the Federal Bureau of Investigation's first homicide investigations. His book, Killers of the Flower Moon, The Osage Murders and the Birth of the FBI, draws on new evidence behind the conspiracy that still haunts Oklahoma to this day.
I read a lot about a woman named Molly Burkhart, an Osage woman who was born in 1886. And in many ways, she is typical of the Osage then. She straddled both two centuries and two civilizations. She grew up in a lodge speaking Osage, practicing Osage traditions, and then because of these massive oil deposits under their land that made them incredibly wealthy, within a few decades, she's living in a mansion. She's married to a white settler. Many of these whites were drawn in by the wealth. She's speaking English. And then, of course, while she's straddling these worlds and trying to kind of navigate between them, her family becomes a prime target of a criminal conspiracy where whites who were drawn into the area because of the oil begin to target them for their oil money and really what is one of the most sinister crimes in American history.
Is the situation of how the oil was discovered and how it was clear that the Osage deserved a piece of that wealth, you know, is that like There Will Be Blood? Is that sort of like that movie that somebody would come during the day, a geologist, and then sign a contract and this would be the deal?
Yeah, so this is where there was a very important chapter of history which happened with the Osage, which set their fate apart from many other American Indian nations, which was they were, like so many other American Indian nations, driven off their land. They once controlled the central part of the country. They were then bunched up in a reservation in Kansas under siege again from white settlers. There was a massacre. And it was then that an Osage chief had stood up and he said, we should move to this territory, which was then an Indian territory, would later become Oklahoma, because the land was rocky and it was infertile. And the white man would finally leave us alone. And so this land that was seemingly worthless, they actually purchased it. So they had a deed to their own land, which is already an important detail. They then resettled. There was only a couple thousand of them. The migrations had taken a tremendous toll on them. Then when oil was discovered on their land and their tribe was being allotted in 1906, they slipped into their treaty a very curious provision at the time, which said, we shall control all the subsurface mineral rights to their land.
So they had national rights, they had property rights, and they had mineral rights.
Exactly right. They had become the world's first underground reservation. And so they controlled all this. The only way anyone could inherit shares in that mineral trust was through inheritance. That was the only way. And that was partly what led to these very sinister, sophisticated plots.
How much money are we talking about?
By 1919, some of these massive deposits were found. And by 1923, in that year alone, these 2,000 or so Osage collectively received what would be worth today more than $400 million. They have become the richest people per capita in the world.
What was the tension like between the success of these Native Americans and the hardscrabble existence that was the norm in much of that part of the prairie?
Well, the greatest tension came from whites. This wealth provoked all sorts of bewildering reactions, and it got to the point that prejudice was so strong that members of the U.S. government and other Americans began to scapegoat the Osage for their wealth. Members of Congress would literally hold hearings saying, what are we going to do about these Osage? How can they have all this money? They can't handle it. And they went so far as to pass legislation requiring many Osage to have white guardians. This system was quite literally racist. It was based on the quantum of Osage blood. So if you were a full-blooded Osage, you were deemed quote-unquote incompetent and given a guardian. And here you could be a great chief who led a nation, who had millions of dollars in your trust, and you could have a white guardian telling you, you can buy this car or not that car, you can get this toothpaste at the corner store. And not only was the system racist, it also created one of the largest state and federally sanctioned criminal enterprises because many of these guardians began to swindle millions of dollars.
The shocking thing about this story is that in the midst of unimaginable wealth, discrimination, injustice, prejudice, hatred, they couldn't succeed even with all those zeros after the dollar sign.
Yes. And in fact, the two forces fused together, which was unbelievable avarice and greed by white settlers with prejudice. And those two forces combine to produce
a final solution.
A final solution, exactly right.
What happened?
So they began to be systematically targeted one by one, and there were poisonings. Poisoning was one of the prime means of killing. And the reason was that it was an incredibly lawless time back then in the country, and there was very little training, and there was also a lot of corruption. And so you could slip somebody a poison and then quickly cover it up.
The FBI at the time, how were they brought to this investigation, which would require the most sophisticated of forensics and a real ability to get inside a criminal conspiracy?
They are brought into the case in 1923 when the Osage Tribal Council, after more than two dozen Osage were murdered, and that's just the official death toll, and nobody had done anything. They had crusaded for justice, but because of prejudice, these crimes were neglected. A few people who had tried to stop the criminals, they were killed themselves. And they had very little jurisdiction over murder cases, but they had jurisdiction over American Indian reservations. And that's why this case fell to them. And they ultimately follow the money, and they are able to capture some of the killers. But one of the things I try to document in the book is that the Bureau and Hoover closed the case prematurely. And because of that, a much deeper and darker conspiracy went unexposed. And the breadth of the killing was far greater, and the number of killers far greater than the Bureau ever was able to expose and handle.
If this was a Hollywood movie, the end of the story would be some corporation called the Osage Oil Company would have gotten all the money and all the oil, and that would be the end of it. Who benefited here? It seems so piecemeal.
This was piecemeal in the sense that there were many seemingly ordinary people who were perpetrating these crimes to individually benefit for their families. And so the wealth was dispersed through these inheritance schemes, and millions and millions and millions of dollars were swindled and never recovered.
What are the scars of this in the territory that you visited?
So one of the things I did was track down the descendants of both the murderers and the victims. And what's amazing is that to this day, descendants of the murderers and the victims often live in the same neighborhoods. They live side by side. Their fates are intertwined. In many ways, that is the story of America. And when you interview the descendants, particularly the victims, I interviewed Molly Burkhart's granddaughter, a lovely woman named Marjorie, and she could tell me what it was like to grow up without relatives, without aunts, to have the money taken, what it was like for her father who grew up in this house of secrets. You get a sense of how this is still living history and how it still reverberates to this day.
David Grant is the author of Killers of the Flower Moon, The Osage Murders, and The Birth of the FBI. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
We're going to finish this hour where we started, now that we've had a chance to think about President Trump's decision to pull America out of the Paris Climate Agreement, an announcement that was made this afternoon, not terribly long ago, in the White House Rose Garden. And we've had some time to absorb some of the charges and accusations the president made about the effects of that agreement on the U.S. environment and the economy.
As of today, the United States will cease all implementation of the non-binding Paris Accord and the draconian financial and economic burdens the agreement imposes on our country.
A look now at the politics, the science, and the political science. Joining us is Heather Goldstone, science correspondent for WCAI and WGBH Radio in Boston, and Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Todd Zwillick, the accusations that the president made, he started by saying he wanted a better deal, a new deal, to go back into the Paris Agreement, but ended his remarks with a fairly draconian critique of this agreement as something that made the world laugh at the United States.
Well, that's right, John. The president started with what was sort of a fairly traditional conservative critique of a climate agreement or economic regulation, that it's a job killer, that it drives up prices for American workers and takes away productivity. It then kind of veered into an anti-globalist diatribe that at times brought in NATO allies not paying their fair share for the common defense and laughing at the United States because it's also locked into an agreement that the president sees as unfair. I thought if the president made any news, and you mentioned it, it was right at the very top where he said the United States would pull out of this agreement but would be open to renegotiating Paris or a similar agreement that was a better deal for America. He's used this type of rhetoric in other trade deals and in other international agreements, including the Iran nuclear deal and others, which we remain in. That was a piece of news, but it's completely unclear how such a negotiation would take place. There is no effort afoot domestically to renegotiate the deal or foment some kind of new treaty. And in terms of the other 194 or 195 countries that are signed on to Paris, John, this is the deal. And I know of no framework in which the other signatories to the deal would be willing to renegotiate on the United States' behalf. Heather may know more about that than I do, but the president's rhetoric of renegotiating a better deal seems to be purely rhetorical at this point.
Well, indeed, this would involve actually gathering the world leaders and the world representatives at a specific event that would need to be convened. It's not like something that you bring up at the Security Council. So it would be much, much more complicated. And the president presumably knows that as he makes that offer. But Heather, I'm wondering if you could comment on the question of lost jobs, the question of the world laughing at the United States, the question of a huge transfer of wealth that the president spoke about in his accusations against the Paris Agreement.
Yeah, well, certainly. I think one thing to note is that many of the downward trends in jobs and in manufacturing that President Trump mentioned in this speech and has been a theme throughout his presidency, those trends began well before the Paris Agreement existed. And in fact, sometimes they're pinned also on President Obama's Clean Power Plan. That is a plan and an initiative that actually never went into effect. So the argument that those are the things driving this shift away from coal, away from manufacturing and to things like renewable energy and different sorts of jobs, that argument doesn't necessarily add up when you look at a lot of those numbers and the timeline of that. You know, to go back to Todd's point, I think it's really unclear what this actually means when he talks about renegotiating or negotiating a way to re-enter, and the language he was using, things about this punishes the United States, imposing obligations while imposing no obligations on other major emitters. Again, I think this goes back to the structure of the Paris Agreement. This kind of language seems to suggest that this is a very top-down agreement that is imposing these things on the United States, when in fact what it is a matter of a voluntary, nationally determined contribution that we willingly put out there. And What is unclear to me is whether those nationally determined contributions can be renegotiated, revised, and revamped at any point. How locked in we are to that contribution that was committed to under the Obama administration, and whether this is as simple as President Trump simply submitting a new nationally determined contribution, or whether it's a matter of waiting a few years for an official withdrawal and reentry kind of negotiation.
I want to finish on Todd Zwillich's assessment of the political implications here. We should note that President Obama has issued a statement almost immediately following the speech, suggesting that indeed, as others have said, that it will be the United States who does not reap the potential leadership role in the environment and in environmentally friendly technology that the signatories of the Paris Agreement will benefit from, and he identified China and India in particular in that way. Todd Zwillich, give us the political implications before we go.
Hard to predict the future, but we can look at the past of this issue, John. Vast majorities of Americans say they think climate change is real and that humans are the cause and that they want their government to do something about it. Voters say that, but any opportunity really that voters have had to enforce that view on American politicians, they've either bypassed or have voted in the opposite direction. Here's an example. It was under Nancy Pelosi's leadership in the House of Representatives when she was Speaker of the House that Democrats barely passed a cap and trade plan. It was a tough vote for Democrats. That plan went and died in the Senate. And a lot of Democrats, John, attribute that vote to them losing their House majority the very next year in midterm elections. And in fact, if that's true, voters turned around and penalized Democrats for a cap and trade plan. These days, even though voters say they care about this issue, they've never enforced it at the ballot box. I can't predict whether finally that will change or whether voters will hold members of Congress accountable. We'll just have to see. I can give you one interesting reaction from Lindsey Graham, who gets a lot of public attention. Lindsey Graham was one of the senators who leaned on the president to stay in the Paris Agreement. He tweeted just after the president's speech that he supports President Trump's desire to re-enter the Paris Accord after the agreement becomes a better deal for America and business. Again, completely unclear what that negotiation would look like or where or how it would ever take place. But there's one senator sort of straddling both sides of that politics that you're talking about. He wanted the president to stay in, but now that we're out, he said he would support a renegotiation, although that it takes an entirely unclear form.
What kind of a voter are you on the fence? Is this something that you're passionate about? Until you get in the ballot box, we'd love to hear from you. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Much more tomorrow on the implications of this, and particularly on those senators who claim to be renegades on this issue of the Paris Agreement. Thanks to Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, and of course to Heather Goldstone, science correspondent for WCAI and WGBH Radio. The invitation is open here on The Takeaway and at all public radio stations around the country. Be a part of the conversation, be a part of the political solution, and the ways in which America will grapple with a very difficult issue now raised by President Trump in withdrawing from the climate agreement in Paris. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering tech products, solutions, and services for business like PC setup and repair, data recovery, and virus protection. More at staples.com/tech services. Staples, it's pro time. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.